rush is not just a gold rush. Before the Klondike was consumed by fortune hunters congesting its creek banks and tiny settlements, there was a formative history taking place there, an evolution of events and men that made that great gold rush possible. On this edition of Conversations, we'll talk with historian Michael Gates about the ragtag risk takers and the dreamers who followed their ambitions one by one into the Klondike and eventually made a rush. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Conversations. Join us for the years before the Klondike Gold Rush. Michael, welcome and thank you.
It's nice to be here.
Give us some sense of time, if you will, to begin. The Gold Rush is dated at 1896.
The discovery was in 1896, and the rush that followed occurred in 1898.
When, how much earlier did that first trickle of men start? And I guess more importantly for my interest anyway, why did it start? Were these people who had followed other gold rushes and had a hunch that they should come north or something else?
That's precisely it. Uh-huh. The first gold seekers came in 1873. It took them a long time. It took them almost 2 years to make the trip. It was a couple of small parties. But amongst that group were some of the most well-known of the early pioneers, Jack McQuestion, Al Mayo, Arthur Harper, Fred Hart. And I think that they had an idea of what to expect. There'd been a gold rush in California in 1848, and there were successive, perhaps smaller gold finds in Oregon and Washington. Mm-hmm. There was the Fraser River in British Columbia, and then there was the Caribou and the Stikine, each one moving farther and farther north. And I think it didn't take a genius to look at the map and realize that if you went farther north, you were probably going to find the same thing.
There's almost a literal vein in the gold miners' ambition. I think we have people who are not miners and have nothing to do with that life, two images that are diametrically opposed of someone who would seek fortune. One is, I think, real negative. This is a guy who is maybe a bounder, irresponsible, can't live with the rest of us. The other image seems to be, as I say, diametrically opposed, someone who follows his dreams, a risk taker, the one that the Walter Mitty and all of us would follow after. Give me a reality of what some of these people were like.
I think before the gold rush, the preponderance of prospectors who were in this area on the Yukon River were true prospectors. They hadn't found large quantities of gold, so they weren't there to cash in on the opportunities. They were there to make them. And they came in hopes of finding a large deposit of gold that would make them rich. I think that was the dream. The reality was that they'd worked in gold fields in other places, and they were pursuing a lifestyle as well. And so they knew what they were up against. And they came in, and they were part of a group who had worked elsewhere, and so I think the rules were known to them. Mm-hmm. The hardships were known to them. I don't think they were equipped for previous experience with the extreme hardships that they encountered in the Yukon, but they had a pretty good idea.
And these were tough, rugged men.
They had to be.
If we come into the Klondike now, we may come in by boat, motorized boat, or airplane, and then roads. This isn't at all what 1873 offered these men. Can you give us a picture of how it was to come north?
People today have a hard time imagining what it would have been like at that time. For one thing, in the winter, they were shut off from the outside world. They might as well have been on the moon. It was so isolated. And the hardships that they endured were very, very extreme compared to what we're accustomed to. Now, let's talk about the isolation for a minute. If they wanted to write a letter, they could write a letter while they're sitting in their cabin in the wintertime, and then they'd put it on the shelf, and they'd have to wait until the spring when the river broke up and the first steamers came up from St. Michael. They could pass the mail on at that time, the mail would be carried out, and perhaps 18 months later they'd receive a reply. Now, some of the early prospectors commented on this. One actually recalled sending a letter out, and when he received the reply, He couldn't recall what the letter was and what he said in the first place. That's how long it took.
Yeah.
Imagine the disappointment of one of the missionaries when the first letter that he received after having spent a year in isolation was a package of samples from his tailor in London, asking which he would prefer for his suit.
Fascinating. This made whatever printed material that was available very valuable.
I mean,
not probably the tailor samples, but...
One prospector in one of the remote creeks received a bundle of newspapers from a friend in Seattle. When word got out about this, everybody converged on his cabin, and they just ravenously digested all the news, which was, by that time, months out of date. And they were so grateful that they took a collection and they sent out $400 in gold nuggets, which at that time was a pretty nice gift, a very nice thank you.
To the person who sent the newspapers.
That's right.
This is Michael Gates with us on this edition of Conversations. He's a historian with Parks Canada. More importantly for our purposes today, he wrote a book called Gold at 40 Mile Creek, The Early Days in the Yukon. It came out from UBC Press, right?
That's correct.
In 1994. And is the history, it began as an ethnography, but is the history of the people and the communities that were centered around the search for gold that eventually led to the Klondike Gold Rush. So 1873 to 1896 or so. Michael Gates, our guest on this edition of Conversations. You said something a minute ago about the steamers would come up only in the spring. Mm-hmm. But pre-73, around the time Jack McQuestion and Al Mayo were coming up, this was not a time of steamers, right? They were
Well, there was one creaky old steamer, the Yukon, at that time. But they didn't use it to get there. They took the hard way. They went overland from northern British Columbia, down the Liard River to the Mackenzie, down the Mackenzie River, up the Peel, across a lengthy portage to the Porcupine River, down the Porcupine River to Fort Yukon. When they arrived at Fort Yukon, they'd been on the trail so long they hadn't had any flour to eat for almost 2 years.
What might Mayo and McQuestion and the others have carried? What's an outfit for a man who decides to come north in 1873 and search for gold?
They didn't write about that, but one can speculate that they didn't carry enough food to tide them over. In fact, they had to winter on the way, so they spent a lot of time sitting around with very little to do. They didn't have the best of equipment either. They didn't see their first repeating rifle until they got to Fort Yukon, so they were using pretty antiquated armaments to do the hunting that they probably relied upon to obtain most of their food.
You're talking about food. You've got a passage in the book that struck me about the trek over the Chilkoot Pass and men being wintered in with only raw oatmeal and candle wax to eat, or only their dogs to keep them warm.
It really depended upon how prepared they were when they came in. Mm-hmm. But in the earliest period, they came in for the summer and then left. It was perhaps easier to bring enough supplies with them if that was their strategy. But if they came in for the winter, they didn't have enough, and sometimes it got pretty grim. When they started wintering over, they had to depend upon the traders, McQuestion, Mayo, Ledoux, Harper, and Hart, to provide them with all the goods that they needed. And the goods weren't very good.
I want to ask you about that. We've got some readings picked out, and I wonder if this is a good time to read about the flour.
Mm-hmm.
Is this...
Yes,
do you think this
yes,
would
indeed.
Work? Let's, once again, the book is Gold at 40 Mile Creek. The author and our guest on this edition of Conversations is Michael Gates. And who's talking here?
A pioneer by the name of Frank Buteau. I'm sorry. Oh. No, I'm sorry. This passage is by Chris Sonnickson.
Right.
And Sonnickson came in 1886, and he lived the remainder of his life in the Yukon. And he was never a successful prospector, but the hardships that he chronicled during his life as a prospector are typical of those that many others experienced. Mm-hmm. And he had this passage, and it talks about the food. And of course, all the supplies that the traders required were brought by steamer up the coast from Seattle. They would be brought up the Yukon River by one of the small fleet of cranky old sternwheelers. And by the time it arrived, it was not in very good shape. And I'll read this, and this will give you an impression of what it was like.
Okay.
Sonnichsen said this, I can answer for 16 other men, got flour in the fall of 1889 that had been soaked in salt water for several days, then shipped up the river, where, while aboard the steamer, it had been soaked and heated, so that we had to chop a sack, or rather split it lengthwise like cordwood. In the middle, we could get about 15 pounds of hard lumps that were not green or yellow like the rest. This we had to powder with a hammer and run it through a sieve before we could use it.
This is a remarkable piece to me, that this is what not just Chris Sonnichsen, but most of the people up there would have to go through to eat at the end of the day.
Not only that, but they would go for years without having fresh vegetables. They survived on a diet of meat and flour and beans and beans and beans. Got pretty monotonous.
Tell me about the health of these men then.
Well, they didn't, for one thing, their diet wasn't the best. And that was the cause of many of their illnesses. Scurvy was a common ailment, a very painful and cruel disease, readily preventable. The native people certainly didn't suffer from scurvy. It was the fools who came in and relied on canned goods and flour to keep them going. And another one that attacked many of the early prospectors was tuberculosis. Again, the result of malnutrition and abusing their bodies and being overworked and tired and very vulnerable to disease. And some of the most famous pioneers like Ledoux and Harper died from that cause.
So, well, even getting rich, Joe Ledoux, the founder of Dawson, was a very rich man when he died, but died relatively young because of the TB.
He could have lived a much longer life.
Yeah. Tell me about the native way of life and I'm interested in what you know about this and the white bring your society with you way of life, where one group would not have any problems with scurvy and the other would. Were there those who learned from the people who could live off the land without getting sick?
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. The prospectors came in, and many of them developed long-term relationships and marriages with native women. And in that early time period, they were ideally suited as partners because they knew how to survive. They knew how to hunt. They knew how to prepare food. They knew how to cope with the long periods of isolation and extreme cold weather. Mm. And they were admirable partners.
Mm-hmm.
Native people never became part of the mainstream of prospecting, though. There were only a few who became involved. Most notable of those was a man named Skookum Jim, who was related by marriage to George Carmack.
And briefly, George Carmack, we'll encounter him again in our discussion. But
well, he brings about the end of my story, because he was the man who, with Skookum Jim and Jim's nephew, Dawson Charlie, in 1896, discovered gold on Bonanza Creek, then known as Rabbit Creek. And it was Carmack who staked the discovery claim. Jim and Charlie also staked claims at that time, and when they announced their discovery, that caused the initial stampede that led to the Klondike Gold Rush.
The call that was heard around the world.
That's right.
There's not much, besides someone like Skookum Jim, there are not many native names in gold history. Is this simply a white man's thing from your perspective?
From my perspective, I would say so, yes.
Uh-huh. And the relationship generally between the two societies was easy, relaxed, uncomfortable, racist? Where do you place it?
Well, there was certainly a racist attitude at the time, and that's reflected in various comments. Certainly the prospectors did not, for example, they did not want Orientals in the Yukon, and they turned back a group of Orientals who arrived at Dai in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
This is noted by Inspector Constantine of the Mounted Police. So they certainly had an attitude against that, and I think they felt threatened by the so-called cheaper labor that came in when the Orientals arrived. The lifestyle that the native people led did not consider gold as an important element of their annual cycle. And so that was something that had to be taught. And I think that was the means by which Skookum Jim became initiated into the prospecting activity.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that George Carmack learned a great deal from Skookum Jim, and Skookum Jim picked up a great deal from Carmack, and together they made a pretty good team.
In some ways, I think Carmack was a bit of an exception, because he became much more involved in the native culture than most of the prospectors did. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if that set him aside. He was known as Siwash George, and he took that as a compliment.
Siwash, I've heard that word a lot. What does that mean?
I think the remark was, George, you, the way you live, you're more like a Siwash. It refers to native people.
Okay. Set him apart, good for him, bad for him, both. Yeah.
From his point of view, I think he took it as a compliment, yeah. Yes.
Michael Gates, our guest on this edition of Conversations. We're taking a look at the years before the Klondike Gold Rush became a stampede. Let's take a look at mining. This is what these men were coming for. So let's spend a little bit of time seeing what they actually did. It seems to me that gold prospectors spent more time moving around and searching than they did actually mining. Is that true, or is that a false impression?
In the early days, that's quite correct. Prospecting is the pursuit of gold, the dream of gold, the hope of finding it.
Uh-huh.
And in the early days, the discoveries were very small, very modest, and most of them were restricted to the bars along the Yukon River and some of the bigger tributaries, most notably the Stewart River. The early prospectors came in with very few tools at their disposal. Initially, they would pan until they found what they thought might be a workable prospect, and then they would construct a rocker, which is a small mining device, they would then take the pay dirt that they were hoping would produce the gold they were looking for, and they would run it through the rocker.
It's a little box, and
it would be
rolled
about
back and
this
forth.
Size.
So that's 3 feet or so.
About that. At the top, there'd be a small tray with holes in the bottom of it, so in that way you'd screen out the big rocks. And with one hand, while you're moving it back and forth like this, you'd be dipping water and pouring it in through the top and washing the material off the big rocks. That would go through a couple of angled aprons of canvas, and there some of the material would be trapped. It would come out at the bottom, and it would run down a series of small riffles, and the gold would be trapped there. A very simple means of recovering gold.
When you say the gold would be trapped there, what's being trapped? Is this color, flecks and flakes, rocks?
The fine particles of gold would be trapped in the riffles. Gold is much heavier than other rock material, and it's 19 times heavier than water. So any time it's flowing down a stream or on any kind of an incline, if there's a small eddy, it immediately drops out.
I see. You have a passage in the book where you describe a group of men. What exactly did you say? Well, I'll paraphrase. They didn't like the look of the trees on the bank, nor did they think gold would be found where there were wild onions growing and something else growing.
That's correct. And so they went down. This was on the
savvy science on their part?
I think that was probably from their own experience.
Uh-huh.
And in that particular instance, they were on the Stewart River, and they decided to try another stream. And they went to 40 Mile Creek. And there, they found the first coarse gold in the Yukon.
And created the first small stampede,
that's right?
Yeah. What was that? What size was that stampede? How many people heard that siren call from your perspective?
Perhaps a couple of hundred.
Uh-huh.
There were perhaps 75 miners and prospectors on the Yukon Basin at the time.
Did you say when that was? Did I miss it?
1886.
Thanks. Go ahead.
The word spread very quickly. By the spring, word had reached Juneau. And prospectors started stampeding from Juneau in a small way, of course. And the prospectors who were already in the Yukon Basin had already made their way to the 40 Mile River before the ice broke up, or as soon as the ice broke up. The others followed in short order. But in order to anticipate the rush, they had to send somebody out with the news. And that task fell to a man named Tom Williams. So in December of 1886, he set out from the mouth of the Stuart River on a journey of more than 300 miles to carry letters to Dai, and from there they could get them to various people.
Now, people will not know Dai, so...
Dai is, it's an abandoned site now, but it was at the head of the Lynn Canal, and it was the beginning of the Chilkoot Trail.
Okay, good. Now come back to your story. This is a great and tragic story.
Arthur Harper knew that with the stampede, they would have to bring in more supplies for all the new miners who would arrive. So from his point of view, it was critical to get a message to Jack McQuestion, who was in San Francisco that winter. So perhaps more than anybody else, it was Harper who needed to get that word out. And he and all the others who were at the post at the mouth of the Stuart River wrote letters to friends and acquaintances to let them know as well. Williams embarked with a young lad and a team of dogs and made his way up the Yukon River. It was an unusually warm December, and in the first part of the trip they had a number of incidents where they fell through the ice, and in one case the ice jammed and the water level rose very quickly, and again they were immersed in water. In some places the river was completely open, so instead of following the easy course along the river, they went to land and worked their way through the brush to detour around the open water. By the time they got to Lake LaBarge, the weather had changed and became brutally cold, and they started running short of supplies. But they pressed on, despite the wise counsel of some of the Indians at Tagish. Mm-hmm. They pressed on, and they got trapped in very, very severe blizzard conditions in the Chilkoot Pass. By the time they arrived at Dai, Williams was exhausted and he died within a couple of hours, but he survived long enough to tell them about the gold.
Do you see Williams and his companion as, his name was Young Bob, no, is that right?
As I recall, yes.
Yeah, who was a young Native man, a teenager, and
right.
who ended up telling this story more fully after Tom's death. Mm-hmm. Do you see the two of them as heroic or foolish or something in between? They both risked their lives. They lost their dogs, they lost the mail, it was hapless in some ways.
They had to do it. They had to get word out. The alternative was starvation.
So they were saving their mates.
By conveying the message to Jack McQuestion, he would be able to bring in more supplies and there would be food for all the prospectors.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, do you think these are hard times creating greatness in men or the opposite?
I think that was just another example of the hardships they had to endure just to survive.
Yeah, okay.
They didn't live in ideal conditions. Some of the early prospectors were very portable. They didn't even bring stoves with them. And when they decided to winter over, they built small log shelters, but they didn't even have the convenience of a stove to keep them warm. There's a passage in my book that describes this.
Let's look at this. And what you're saying to me indirectly is that just like Buteau's cabin, which we're going to read about now, what Tom Williams and Young Bob did was just expected.
I think so.
Okay. Let's go back to Gold at 40 Mile Creek, the early days in the Yukon. The book is by Michael Gates from UBC Press. And we're going to take a look at the home that Buteau and his partners built. Please.
The passage goes like this.
Yeah.
The home that Buteau and his two partners built was nothing more than a small log shack, barely 10 feet to a side, with a simple shed roof. It lacked even the most basic essentials. They had no stove or stovepipe, so they first built a chimney out of wood in the center of the cabin, with an open fire beneath it, but this was too cold. Their second attempt, a Russian furnace made out of mud and stones, was much more successful. They had no glass for a window, so they resorted to a block of clear river ice. Their shack provided them with little comfort. So cold was it that the same block of ice remained in that window without melting for the entire winter. Nor was their winter well illuminated, for they had only a half a dozen candles. And this is typical of the circumstances. Chris Sonicson, mm-hmm. also had a cabin. He simply lit a fire in the middle of the floor and had an opening in the roof to allow the smoke to escape. So they lived in these cabins. It fended off the severe cold, but it didn't get above freezing. And they lived like that all winter.
Now, this is something we haven't looked at yet. What's the mining season and the inside season? It's a far longer period of time that is winter where they can't work at this point, right?
That's right. Well, the first strategy was to come in for the summer. So they had to cross the Chilkoot with their supplies and wait until the headwaters broke up and the lakes were free of ice before they could float down. It was easy going downriver because the current carried them. And they would check the bars and the tributaries looking for gold. But by the beginning of August, they had to start thinking seriously about leaving. And the reason for that was they were going upstream. They didn't have motor boats or steamboats to carry them. They had to do it themselves. And so they would embark on a trip that would take 4 to 6 weeks back up to the headwaters of the Yukon River and over the Chilkoot Pass before it was snowed in for the winter. Mm-hmm. So that meant that there was a very short window for them during which they could mine. And during that time, they also had to move around from one place to another, and they also had to provide for themselves. So I don't think they did as much prospecting as they did surviving. After a few years of this, they started to realize that they could improve their odds a little bit by staying in over the winter. And that would probably double the amount of time they had for prospecting, but it also meant that they ended up isolated in some remote location for 6 to 7 months of the year, idle.
And experimenting with very rough living circumstances.
That's correct.
Yeah. Michael Gates is our guest on this edition of Conversations. Once again, the book is Gold at 40 Mile Creek. The University of British Columbia Press put it out in 1994. It's available. It's not only a fascinating history of the lives that people led as they searched for gold, but actually if you're interested in tracing family members who may have been there, there is a long list of names that Michael encountered in his study. There's a good bibliography. There's some information about how gold was mined for. You'll find a lot in this book called Gold at 40 Mile Creek. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Michael Gates is our guest. Now, we're talking about being forced inside. This led to the sensibility that we can do some mining in the winter, didn't it?
Eventually.
Yes. Eventually. Roughly when and what did they invent to help them or develop to help them mine through the winter?
Well, even from the earliest times, they used fire. And because we live in a land of permafrost, the gold-bearing gravels were locked up in ice. And that happens throughout the year. Their first attempts at dealing with this took place in the summer along the bars of the Yukon River. In 1882, Jack McQuestion and Joe Ledoux and a number of other prospectors tried on the 60 mile to sink a shaft to the pay zone using fire to thaw the ground and allow them to excavate it. Mm-hmm. They eventually got flooded out and they gave up, but they knew about fire. It wasn't until they were mining on the 60 mile and the 40 mile that they perfected the technique. And Miller Creek was very well known for the drift mining that took place there. They would start by lighting a fire at a selected location. And as soon as the fire subsided, they would excavate the ground that had thawed as a consequence. Then they'd light another fire, and they'd repeat that cycle until they got down to bedrock. When they hit bedrock, they'd light fires, and they would work in a horizontal fashion along bedrock, and they'd cross-cut the valley in hopes of intersecting the pay streak. And they might do that several times on their claim. They just space them up the claim from the top to the bottom.
And what this is giving them is great piles of potential that they can then sort through.
This material would be hauled to the surface. They would pan a little bit out in their cabins, and that would give them some idea of how much gold was there. And once they knew that they were in the pay streak, they'd start stockpiling this, and this was called a dump. And these dumps would accumulate over the winter, and then in the spring when the water started to run, they'd shovel that into a sluice box and get the gold out.
And the sluice box is pairs of long, narrow boxes that carry gold down with the water, yes? Or
the water is diverted through through a wooden channel,
yeah,
usually about this wide, probably about that deep.
Foot by foot or so, sure.
It would be at an incline, and that would vary, but probably an inch to a foot. And water would be diverted through that. They would shovel the material, the pay dirt, into this. And because the bottom was lined with a series of riffles, the gold would be trapped as the material was washed through to the bottom of the sluice.
Okay. This innovation allowed miners to extend their...
It extended their mining season
throughout
the year.
Okay.
And it increased the productivity. It meant they didn't have to lay idle for 7 months of the year. And it was a very significant step forward for them.
Okay.
But all this work was done with hand labor. None of this was done with the benefit of machinery.
This is pretty remarkable. Over and over again, as I've reading the book and as I'm listening to you today, I'm just thinking these are muscled and toughened creatures who are doing this. Mm-hmm. And that makes me wonder about the society in which they lived. You've described it as an anarchy in the early years. There's no government, there's no authority.
There was no authority but their own.
Yeah.
And there was a very strict authority.
That's what I want to know about.
Well, let me give you a passage from my book.
Good. Tell me where you are, because I don't know where we're going. I'll find the page with you.
Yeah, it'll take me a moment to leaf through it.
Well, Michael's leafing through. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest. Michael Gates, as I said earlier, works with Parks Canada. He began working with Parks Canada in 1978 as an historian. He is curator of collections for the Klondike National Historic Sites in Dawson, Yukon. He makes his home in Dawson, born in Calgary. His education, his most recent degree, is a master's in history and museum studies from the State University of New York. And as you may have gathered or guessed as we were talking, the early work for Michael's book, which took 7 years to write, the preliminary work, was his master's thesis. Are we there?
Let me set the stage a little bit.
Good. Tell me what page you're on so I can read along, too.
Okay. Well, this is on page 25.
All right. I'm with you. Set the stage.
Their hair and beards had grown long, and their faces were tanned and weather-beaten by constant exposure. Their garments, then in the last stages of serviceability, had been made by those who wore them from any material that chanced to be available, from buckskin and fur to flour sacks, and had been repaired without regard to color or texture. One not accustomed to the vicissitudes of exploration, coming suddenly on such a scene, would certainly believe that he had stumbled on a band of the most desperate outlaws.
Yeah.
But they certainly weren't that. And I want to give you a bit of a description of what these fellows were like. And this is another passage from my book. These early Yukoners were suspicious of authority and any of the restraints it placed upon them. They were courteous in rough countries, where each must travel on his own merits and fight his own battles. Yet they would offer their home, food, and a bed to sleep in without even asking the guest his name. If someone was short of supplies, no questions were asked. Whoever had something would share with those who had nothing, even if it was their last morsel. And, of course, this became the miner's code and the credo by which the Yukon Order of Pioneers subscribed, and that was, do as you would be done by. And it had many elements of survival in it, because if you found yourself in a tough situation, you had to rely upon the others to help you through it.
This was a recognition of need and service. It only made sense that you didn't cheat. It only made sense that you didn't steal.
That is correct.
Because there wasn't much and you depended on.
That is correct. Yeah. And they dealt very harshly with anybody who violated those rules.
The dealing harshly with anyone who violated the rules was at first not organized, but miners' committees came into being, and that kind of organized this.
That is correct.
Tell us about the kind of the trial and judgment system that evolved.
Well, it was a very loosely constituted democratic organization that was assembled when and where circumstances required. For instance, one of their basic functions was, if gold was found in an area, the miners would get together and establish the rules by which they would mine. Most important was, how big would the claims be? They would nominate someone to serve as a mining recorder, and this person would keep a list of whose claims were whose and any transactions that took place. And this allowed them to keep some order to their mining activities. But it was very flexible. For instance, in 1887, they had assigned themselves fairly lengthy pieces of creek bottom for the purpose of mining. But as the summer wore on, they realized that there were far too many prospectors for the size of the claims, and so they redefined them and made them much shorter. And this enabled all of the prospectors to recover enough gold to grubstake them for another year.
This is very democratic.
Yes, it was. Another thing that they dealt with, and they could deal quite severely with infractions that might be life-threatening. Theft of food was a serious infraction, and banishment was the punishment if someone was found guilty by a miner's meeting. And it didn't matter if it was in the dead of winter. If they were banished, they had to go. One fellow named Jack Leslie tried to kill his mining companions in the winter of 1886-87. They caught him in the act, prevented him from killing them.
He was trying to poison them, wasn't he?
Well, first he tried to poison them, and when that didn't work, he waited until he thought they were asleep, and he pulled out his gun. One of the other members of the party was pretending that he was asleep, and when he saw him pull out the gun, he jumped up, and they took him into custody. They took him down the Stewart River to Mayo's trading post, and there they had a miners' meeting. And they decided that he should be banished. So in the dead of winter, Jack Leslie left for the outside. And he took with him a peculiar story, and that story was that there had been an insurrection amongst the local Indians and that several of the prospectors had been killed. So as he made his way out...
He made it up.
He made it up.
Yeah.
As he made his way out, he told all the prospectors that he met this fabrication. And in fact, when William Ogilvie came in to locate the international boundary the following spring.
And Ogilvie was?
William Ogilvie was a Canadian government surveyor.
Good, thank you.
Came in with a small entourage to survey the boundary. He encountered Jack Leslie at where Haines is now located. He heard the same story, and it did cause him some alarm, but it didn't deter him from carrying on.
It would be possible to create, like Leslie tried to do, great fictions about life on the Yukon and therefore kind of skew history, but it doesn't seem that that happened.
Not really. However, the miners were a little bit suspicious of revenuers. And William Ogilvie noted that when he came into the Yukon, he would stop to talk to them, and they weren't too talkative. They didn't want to tell him anything they didn't have to. He eventually gained their confidence, and I think he became highly respected by them in the end. And his rapport with the prospectors made it possible for him to become the second commissioner of the Yukon. And the reason he became the second commissioner was the first, unfortunately, became involved in some questionable activities. There were a number of corrupt civil servants who worked in his administration, and he was fired. And they decided that after an experience like that, they had to bring someone in whose honesty couldn't be questioned, and Ogilvie fit the bill.
Smart thing to do. One of the things, I think if I remember this right, that Ogilvie and others from the Canadian government encountered was that there much like the native population, the miners didn't have much understanding of or respect for boundaries, which made it slightly complicated for the Canadian government to govern?
Well, there really was no boundary until 1895. And so they were working in a hinterland that belonged to no one except them, or perhaps it belonged to the Aboriginal peoples who'd been there for thousands of years. But it certainly didn't belong to the Canadian government, and it didn't belong to the U.S. government. They knew where the boundary crossed the Yukon River, and that was about it. So when gold was found on the 40-mile River, nobody really knew if it was on Canadian or American soil. And that was the case until Ogilvie surveyed south of the Yukon River into the gold fields in 1895. But by that time, the Mounted Police had arrived. And that set the stage for a number of very interesting circumstances.
Can we back up just a second? Because yes. I wanted to ask you about the miners' committees. It seems to me that the kind of the decline of the miners' committee dovetailed with, led to the coming in of the Northwestern Mounted Police. Is that true?
Correct.
And what caused the decline? Too many people?
Well, a different kind of people started coming in. Once the gold fields in the 40 mile were discovered, it was a real enticement for more to come in. And some of these people weren't there to look for gold. They were there to mine the miners. And they hung out in the saloons.
Mm-hmm.
Their character was rather more questionable than that of the prospectors. In fact, when the prospectors developed the Yukon Order of Pioneers, they used the date 1888 as the dividing point. And they felt that anybody who had been in the Yukon prior to 1888 was of sterner stuff and whose integrity was much more trustworthy. It was after that time that they started to see, in their eyes, a decline.
Mm-hmm.
So as years went on, the miners' meetings fell into some disrepute. And that was because of the context, when they were held in saloons,
uh-huh.
where alcohol was available,
yeah.
and you had people who no longer shared the same esprit de corps that the prospectors did, it undermined the purpose of the miners' meeting. And there were a number of meetings which resulted in decisions that were highly questionable, even by some of the participants. And in the end, I think when the Mounted Police came in, it wasn't because of the miners' meetings, but they displaced the miners' meetings. And the ultimate showdown came in the summer of 1896 on Glacier Creek.
This was my question. Did the miners welcome the Mounties?
It was kind of a Mexican standoff at first.
Uh-huh.
But they tested them that year. And I'll tell you the circumstances.
Please.
One of the prospectors or mine holders on Glacier Creek gave a lay on his claim to another prospector. Now, a lay is simply a share in which somebody else does the work and you simply get a portion of the proceeds. Mm-hmm. So this other fellow hired people, and they worked the claim for the winter. And when the spring came around, he disappeared, and he didn't pay any of the workers. So they were rather upset, and they held a miners' meeting, and at that meeting they decided the fellow who owned the claim was responsible for paying them all. Well, he said, "Don't look at me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't run away with the money. It's not my fault." And they said, "That's too bad." They took his claim by force, and they put it up for auction. They sold it to one of the other prospectors who went down to 40 Mile to register this transfer of ownership with the Mounted Police. The Mounted Police came in bearing a number of mantles, and Inspector Constantine, amongst other duties, was the mining recorder. Well, he was aware of the situation. He'd been appraised by the legitimate owner.
Mm-hmm.
And so he refused to register this transfer. And the fellow left, promising doom and gloom and swearing that his buddies would stand by him. Well, Inspector Constantine instructed Inspector Strickland to take a small detail. I think there were 10 or 11 of them. They went up the 40 Mile River and they crossed over to Glacier Creek. They came down to the claim in dispute and they set up camp there. And they took possession of it and they had a bit of a showdown. No shots were fired. I think the prospectors knew that they were dealing with a new kind of justice, and they lost.
Uh-huh.
And from that point on, it was British justice that ruled the Canadian Yukon. And it was very timely, because it was only a few weeks later that George Carmack made his discovery that led to the stampede. And as we all know, the Klondike Gold Rush, if it wasn't many things, it was extremely peaceful and it was extremely orderly. And the credit has to go to the Mounted Police.
Can I ask you, we have to step away from our story for this question, but can I ask you how you became interested in this story and what has in the last decade or so been the core of your abiding interest?
Well, I love the country up there. And I used to, when I was younger, go out and backpack through remote terrain in search of some of the remains that have been left on the landscape by humans. My curiosity would then lead me to find out what these remains represented. And it kind of opened my eyes when I discovered that there were remains on Miller Creek that predated the Gold Rush. Mm-hmm. We all carry with us, I think the most familiar work on the Gold Rush is a book by Pierre Burton in the United States. Its title is is Klondike Stampede. And the picture that's painted is that there was a discovery and a sudden inrush of people. But in fact, the discovery made by George Carmack was the result of almost 25 years of, if not really organized, it was certainly thorough prospecting by hundreds and hundreds of prospectors who were scattered up and down the Yukon River.
Mm-hmm. And this is where your fascination lies, is in the lives that were lived there.
I realized when I started looking into the material that I found on Miller Creek that there was no book that told the whole story, a little bit here, a little bit there. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to put that story together.
What kinds of materials became grist for your story? Where did you go to find what you find, and what did you find?
Well, there were published accounts, and usually they would make reference to other sources of information, so I would pursue those. There was a scholar down in the United States who had looked at the miners' system of justice. Thorough research, excellent footnoting. So I went to the footnotes and I identified other sources of information, and I went to those. And any book that came on the market, I had an insatiable appetite for books, I would buy and I would read. And one in particular that I remember is one called The Last Frontier by Melody Webb. And again, she had excellent footnotes, and I went to those, and they identified sources that I hadn't found anywhere else. Mm-hmm. I tracked those sources down, and I found there were a wealth of information. Particularly useful to me was a collection of papers known as the Snow Papers, and they ended up in Dartmouth College down in the east. I contacted them, and they sent me a microfilm copy.
Just a half-second thought. Snow was an actor and a theater man, wasn't he?
Well, he was also one of the early pioneers. He came in 1888. Mm-hmm. He prospected. He came back a few years later with a theater troupe and established a theater in 40 Mile. And in 1894, when they established the Yukon Order of Pioneers, they nominated him to be their official historian. And over the years, various prospectors wrote their recollections down. One of them, as I recall, was written in pencil on what appeared to be brown paper bag. They sent them to him. He assembled them, and at the time of his death, he was working on some kind of manuscript that was never completed.
Was this a gold mine for you, not to misuse the word, but when you ran across, or when the Snow Papers arrived?
Oh, it was marvelous. Yeah. And it was written in the words of these men, and these men were not scholars, they were not academics, and they weren't grammarians, but they had first-hand experience, and they wrote about what they remembered and what they thought was important. And that was the story that I thought was important, not some abstract synthesis, but rather a story that is kind of a patchwork quilt of reflections and memories of many of the participants. And you put that together, it forms a very rich tapestry.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide there was more than a thesis here? Why did you decide that there should be a book, or how? Or
well, when I sent my thesis off, I hadn't researched all the material. Some of it was very long in arriving in my postbox. So no sooner had I put my thesis in the mail than I started receiving more material, including the Snow Papers. I really didn't know at that point just how valuable they would be, not until I had them in my hands. And I was so disappointed. I thought that the story was complete, and it wasn't. So I told my wife, Kathy, that I wanted to keep at it, and I thought that perhaps someday I'd be able to write a story. But this one would be not for the academics, but it would be for the average reader. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I wouldn't have it in the format of an ethnography, but rather as a chronological sequence that showed the gradual changes that took place from when McQuestion, Harper, and Mayo arrived until until Carmack's made his timely discovery.
Mm-hmm. I have just a logistics question. Why the list of miners and providers? When did you decide and how did you decide to put all these names in? It's great to read through. And
I can't recall precisely, but I thought it was important. I wanted to get some idea of just how many were there, and I accumulated approximately 1,200 names. And I also thought that if I was writing a book that other people would be interested in, if I included the names, people might be able to track names in there of early relatives.
And is that proving true?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And people have written to me, and I've had some very nice correspondence with people whose ancestors are listed in the in that list in the back of the book.
I didn't ask you this beforehand, but would you mind if people wrote to you who are listening today?
I have no objections at all, and my address is in the foreword of my book.
All right. Okay. Boy, that's good. Buy the book, find Michael's address, and find a relative. There also is for someone like me, this was a delight. There's an extensive bibliography along with the index and list of names, and as I said earlier, some basic information. If you know nothing about gold mining and gold, there's some basic information about mm-hmm. in one of the appendices in the book.
And for the next few years, you can read the book, and it will tell you what was happening precisely 100 years ago.
And related to that, you have brought a card with you that talks about some of the centennial celebrations. Can you just give people names and dates? Now, depending on when people are listening to this, not all of these dates will be still in the future, but I think it would be good to know some of the celebrations of the centennial.
The Yukon is going through a decade of anniversaries, and we're just having a ball doing this. This year, we're celebrating the centennial of the arrival of the first detachment of mounted police in 1895. And there are a number of events that have been scheduled for this year. Some of them have already taken place. For instance, the Mounted Police have a patrol, 9 snowmobiles and 3 dog teams, and they're traveling from Dawson City to Fort McPherson and back. And they're retracing the steps of the old patrols that went between those two points in earlier times. A very exciting undertaking, and they got a tremendous amount of sponsorship for that. As well, this summer, they're bringing the musical ride to Dawson City on July 26th. Put that in your diary. But also, they're going to be here in Fairbanks on August 1st and 2nd.
It's 1995.
That's right. Okay. And the musical ride consists of 36 mounted policemen in full red serge on beautiful black mounts doing the most intricate maneuvers on their horses. And it's a real sight to watch. Very spectacular.
And just headlines briefly into the next couple of years.
1996, we're celebrating the discovery of gold. We're going to be sponsoring the World Gold Panning Championships, which will take place in August 19th to 25th, just after the celebrations of discovery are complete. People from all over the world will be converging on Dawson, and we'll have several hundred very fanatical panners, gold panners. Europeans in particular are absolutely obsessed with it. And you're going to see the best panners in the world there for a whole week of excitement.
Competitive panning, not something one would have conceived of.
That's right. Now, 1997 is the centennial of word being spread to the outside world. I have with me a little gift that I'm going to give to you.
Really?
Now, this is a small cardboard box, and it looks like a brick of gold. And it's very shiny, and it's gold-colored. And inside, there's about a pound of chocolate.
Oh,
and this comes from the chocolate claim in Whitehorse. What is happening in 1997 is a reenactment of the first steamer to leave the Yukon, carrying the now wealthy prospectors to Seattle and San Francisco. And when they arrived in Seattle, I think the headlines read "A ton of gold."
Uh-huh. Spreading the word.
And they're going to carry a ton of chocolate bricks.
Oh, thank you.
And I think they're also going to carry a ton of gold. At least when they arrive in Seattle, they'll have a ton of gold on board. And they're now taking reservations for those people who want to go along in this expedition. It'll start from Dawson. It'll go to Skagway. And they'll get on a luxury cruise liner there. And it will make its way down the coast to its final destination in Seattle.
Okay. Parks Canada celebrating the discovery of gold in the Yukon.
Well, this is the territory. Parks Canada has a very minor role, although we will be opening the commissioner's residence in Dawson on August 17th in 1996.
Has Parks Canada taken on the task of making sure the physical history of the miners, like the commissioner's house, last in the Yukon,
That's our commitment, to preserve and protect things of national, natural, or cultural significance for the enjoyment, education, and benefit of future generations. That's the very core of our mandate. And in Dawson, we have about 35 properties, historic structures. We also have a two-mile stretch of Bonanza Creek known as the Upper Bonanza Reserve. We have a reserve on the claims at Discovery, and we also have a reserve on a number of claims upon which rests Dredge Number 4, the biggest wooden-hulled dredge in North America, which has just recently been removed from the mud and put onto a fresh foundation. It was a major moving job, 3,000 tons of wood and steel, but we did it.
This may sound like a foolish question to you, but why?
We can't preserve it when it's buried 20 feet in the mud.
I mean, why the whole preservation movement from your perspective? Why do we as people, as nations, two of us, moving into the future, need to carry some sort of living history of this period with us?
Let me speak about my own experience, if I may, because it comes from my heart, and I think that's what it's all about. I love the history. I love coming in contact with the very physical remains of the history. It stimulated my interest, and it was the reason I moved to the Yukon, because I was in such direct contact. Those things are being lost, and when we lose them, we lose the very spirit of that stimulation. And as I say to various groups when I speak to them, in conclusion, that the things that stimulated me to ask the questions that led to my book have since been obliterated. Now, my daughter can't go out into the gold fields now and see the same things that I did and ask the same questions and learn the same things. And so we have to preserve some legacy for future generations. And that's why we have been so involved in Dawson City for the last 25 years.
The need to know where we came from,
yes.
Where our community came from.
That's correct.
Michael Gates, thank you so very much for spending an hour with us. It's an interesting hour, and I must say, it's my good fortune to be able to read the books that the guests come to talk about. This is a very interesting book. I think you'll learn a lot if you stop to read it.
Thank you very much, and I hope that you're able to visit us in Dawson City.
But I hope so, too, and to our listeners. Now, let me tell you one more time, Gold at 40 Mile Creek, The Early Days in the Yukon, from the University of British Columbia Press, Vancouver. It's 150 pages with nice appendices. It came out in 1994. Its author is Michael Gates, and you'll find Michael preserving history in Dawson. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening. I hope you join us again next week for Conversations.